We're talking with John Meller, and this is the 30th of May in 2003. John, you did a book in 1962 called The Economics of Agricultural Development. It was 1966, I'm sorry, yeah. And this book was recognized by the American Agricultural Economics Association as a publication of enduring quality. And indeed, it had 6 printings in hardcover, and it had 3 more printings in softcover. It's still available online. I know because I got it online. And the last edition was in 1980, so that really sounds like it's enduring quality. What major issues that you discussed then are still relevant today?
Well, first of all, I was trying to think of that I should give a complicated answer, and the simple answer is all of it. Let me just back up a little bit. I'm from an older generation, as you might guess. I can remember when I was studying as an undergraduate at Cornell, I had a course in which an interesting reading in it was the question whether sunspots affected the economy in the U.S. And the argument was that the sunspots affected agriculture. There's a little bit to be said for that. And agriculture was sufficiently important, so it influenced the overall economy. Well, in 1947, that was true. So I was brought up in an era in which, even in the United States, agriculture was a substantial part of the total economy. So to move, and then I studied at Oxford in 1951-52, and I got a very small assignment from our foreign aid program at that time to help the British on mechanization of agriculture. So I got exposed a little bit to the foreign aid process, and it was quite natural for me to notice when foreign aid started to shift to particularly Asian countries and later somewhat to African countries. Now, I did my PhD dissertation at Cornell. I worked under Frosty Hill, who was a very well-known economist in those days. And I did my PhD dissertation on the southeastern United States, trying to explain why the southeastern United States was so backward. And I got a little hint of what was the problem, but of course we found out in the Eisenhower administration the main thing wrong in the southeastern United States, they didn't have any roads, and we got an interstate highway system under Eisenhower that suddenly put the South on the road map, and they quickly became integrated, and we don't think of, well, maybe some of us politically think a part of the South is backward, but we don't think of it as a backward economic region anymore. The other thing, I'm rambling a little bit, and I apologize for that, but the other thing is that if you're at Cornell, you're aware of Asian countries. Cornell had a very distinguished program with what was then called Nanking University in China. Professor Love, yes, in plant breeding, worked in that program and brought a very major effort to China. And we had distinguished members of the Ag Economics Department who worked in China with J. Lossing Buck, the husband of the famous novelist who won a Nobel Prize. And J. Lossing Buck did the first big agricultural survey in China. And Glenn Headland, who was later chairman of the department, worked on that program in China, and I believe I'm correct that Stan Warren also worked in that program. And Hedlund took the train from Western Vladivostok in Russia all the way across Russia. So I had a lot of exposure to international affairs, and that got me interested in the agriculture. And then this is part of an early history of development in the College of Agriculture of International Affairs. There was a very well-known organization called the Agricultural Development Council. It was initially called the Council on Economic and Cultural Affairs, run by Art Mosier, who was at Cornell for a number of years. And Art found out that I was teaching a course on agricultural development and was basing it heavily on my work in southeastern United States. He said, you need to get out to a developing country. And so his foundation provided a grant that would allow me to take a leave from Cornell. And originally I was to go to Japan, but Japan developed all of a sudden, and so I went to India instead. And got that perspective.
And that was about what year was that?
I was in India in 1958 until 1960. And I lived in a village about 120 miles from Delhi, 20 miles from Agra, where the Taj Mahal is, and interviewed 30 farmers. And by the way, I remember giving a lecture at Cornell maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and someone in the audience in the question period said, you know, you write entirely from experience in India, which isn't quite true. I've worked in a lot of countries, but and we have to be very careful about generalizing from India. And I said, no, I'm not generalizing from India. I'm generalizing from the 30 farmers that I interviewed over a two-year period in India. Okay, yeah. So I had a pretty intensive experience. All that's reflected in the book, and I think the book holds up pretty well now. That in any low or middle-income country, agriculture is crucial to growth and employment, and we know why that is. Yeah. If you grow the industrial sector but not agriculture, you have very poor employment performance. If you grow agriculture along with industry, employment does very well, and the book went into some of that. And I'd like to say one other thing about the award on my early book. Prior to my getting that award for, in a sense, the sustainability of what I was saying, I got the award for best published research for a paper entitled, it was just a paper, not a book, entitled Towards a Theory of Agricultural Development. And that theory is what underlines the book, pretty much. So it was a nice sequence from the award for the best published research to the one for enduring quality. I probably evaded your question somewhere along
the way. No, that's fine. But I should remind listeners to this interview that they can read that book online on Cornell's eCommons. So we have a book that is, in fact, very durable. Let's go back to the history of international programs at Cornell. Can you describe that early history?
Well, two or three things. I was involved in the Social Science Research Council at Cornell, and one of the prominent members of that steering committee was Mario Einaudi in the government department. He was the son of the former president of Italy, as many people would know. Mario was very interested in international affairs and kept bringing that up at the Social Science Research Council.
Was that the Social Science Research Center or Social Science Research Council?
Well, I think it was the Social Science Research Council that then resulted in the center.
Okay.
I'm a little hazy on that, but I think that's correct. And I was on the board for the center also as a very young faculty member at that time.
Now, this became the Center for International Studies.
Well, out of that grew the creation of the Center for International Studies. And all of that effort was was basically an arts college effort. And how should I put it? When I was involved in those things, I don't know how to put this, but I realized that I was from the lower social classes in that they somehow thought agriculture was some importance, so they needed one of those creatures, but one should be careful about too much prominence to them at all. And I pushed very hard for a substantial agricultural input into the budding center. Of course, Mario Einaudi was appointed as the director of that center, and he really formed it. And then there were co-associate directors. One was Stephen Muller, and I was the other one. And when Mario retired from the chairmanship of the Center for International Studies, Steve Muller took over. Mm-hmm. I remained as the sole associate director. When Steve left to become president of Johns Hopkins University, I became the acting director for, I don't know, something like a year or something or other.
And this would have been in the early 1960s.
Yes, yes. So I was the acting director while they searched for a director. And I don't think they were going to have somebody in the ag school as the director of it. You'll notice now that Randy Barker was the director of the Southeast Asia Studies program. That shows a big change. So if you go back to the early period, there was some tension between the College of Agriculture and the Arts College-dominated Center for International Studies. And I was on the Center for International Studies side trying to get some integration and constantly pushing that the physical and biological sciences in agriculture needed to be involved. You can't develop an economy without a low-income economy without agriculture. You can't do agriculture without agronomy and plant breeding and the various other sciences. But that was a big struggle, and I think it was in recognition of that struggle that the College of Agriculture decided that it should do its own program. And so I was involved in the discussions that led up to that, but not directly involved in its formation.
The Ford Foundation was also a factor in some of this early history.
Yes, in those days, the Rockefeller Foundation was the leader in bringing scientific agriculture to what were then called low-income countries, Asia, Latin America, Africa. And of course, the Rockefeller Foundation founded the International Rice Research Institute, which gave us the Green Revolution, the rice varieties that tripled rice yields throughout Asia. Ford was very much, not quite right to put it this way, but Rockefeller was the experienced foundation in founding those institutions. Ford put a lot of money into it, and Ford Foundation recognized that agriculture was very important in the development process, put a lot of money supporting the Rockefeller activities, and then did a lot of activities directly on their own, and providing funding to Cornell was part of that activity. And I'm a little hazy in my memory as to when Frosty Hill left as the chairman of the Agricultural Economics Department at Cornell and a former president of the Agricultural Economics Society to become a senior vice president of Ford Foundation. But it must have been somewhere in that period. And he had a very profound impact on the Ford Foundation when he got there, pushing them heavily towards agriculture, working closely with the Rockefeller Foundation. And I can't remember whether this grant was while he was there. The grant to Cornell, the initial one, was probably before Frosty went to Ford Foundation. But the Ford Foundation in those days was an out front thinking organization. They had real intellectuals on basic development processes and so on there, and were providing leadership. And their helping Cornell was a very big deal. That it was worth listening to them, and I think people at Cornell did listen to them.
And weren't they instrumental in the formation of the International Agriculture Development Program?
Yes, there's no question about that. They provided an intellectual input. someone to bounce off of, and money. And even those who didn't want the intellectual input, they'd at least listen to get the money. So it was a very, very important relationship there.
Yeah. Now, the Bradfield Committee
The Ford people recognized this distinguished history of Cornell in international affairs, and in particularly in Asia and Latin America. And that's what brought them there, was here was an institution that had a history and had a distinguished record. Let's bring that up.
Since you mentioned that, would you say that Cornell was unique in this regard among universities in the U.S.?
Yes, probably the right way to put it is Cornell was out front, and the others were coming along. And Cornell was out front. I indicated there was tension between the arts college people on international affairs and agriculture. I don't want to overblow that, but it was there in the background. But that was a very important feature. The fact that Cornell had the best Southeast Asia Studies program in the U.S. Did strengthen the work that we did. And we had a strong South Asia Studies program in those days also. So when I was going to India, I took 12 hours of Hindi at Cornell. I was on the faculty at the time, and I interacted with distinguished anthropologists who were working on India at the time. So this powerful international context of the other colleges, and particularly arts and sciences, was a real plus when institutions like the Ford Foundation looked at the College of Agriculture. And as I say, there were tensions there, but we all knew it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So back to the Bradfield Committee. You were part of that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was a significant force in this evolution of the International Agriculture Program.
Absolutely. And Dick Bradfield, he was a distinguished agronomist, soil scientist, but he had also had intensive experience with the Rockefeller Foundation in Mexico. Once again, you were drawing on people who had these international contacts. And so you had a distinguished agronomist with a very solid international background, and he was Dick was considerably older than myself at that time. Well, he would still be older than myself, but I was sort of a junior member on the committee. But I knew I was on the committee being led by a very distinguished, not a social scientist, but biological scientist, and who knew his way around in countries like Mexico.
Yes.
With that kind of background, of course it was influential. Okay,
yes.
People recognized what was there.
Yeah. Now the
he must have been chairman of the agronomy department at the time. So you know you had a very distinguished scientist who really knew international affairs, leading the effort within the college.
Yeah.
And that couldn't have happened if there hadn't been this history behind it.
It's the 50th anniversary of international agriculture's international activities.
Quite horrified. It makes me feel very old when I hear that.
What do you think have been the most important contributions that international agriculture, the program in the College of Agriculture, has made to development?
You can get the precise facts from Randy Barker on this, but he made the comment to me the other day that when he's continually working in the Philippines now, where he's had a distinguished connection, commented how many people in the Philippines working in agriculture have PhDs from Cornell. And if I understood him correctly, the number of Filipinos doing a PhD in agriculture at Cornell now is, brace yourself, zero. The great contribution from Cornell all over the world came in the early days when the U.S. Foreign Assistance Program understood that you couldn't develop agriculture without highly trained people. Modernizing agriculture in India or the Philippines is a scientific process. It's one that has to be understood still by illiterate farmers. But don't forget, illiterate farmers are just as intelligent as the rest of us. They just don't have the formal education. So you're dealing with intelligent people, at least two-thirds of them. But it calls for a little different approach. But you need a College of Agriculture. You need people with PhD degrees training it there. You need teaching there. You need people doing research. And what Cornell did was to turn out large numbers of those people back in those earlier days. Unfortunately, the American aid program has gotten out of that. I say to Africans, you know, our aid program in Africa came much later than Asia, and I say to Africans, you know, we Americans, we discovered how to do agricultural development in Asia, and we're not going to make the same mistake in Africa. There's a startled silence when I say, it's true. We've done very little training of people in Africa. So the big contribution of Cornell is providing any country in Asia you go to, the older faculty members, high proportion of them were trained at Cornell. And of course, U.S. aid was supporting other universities doing this. So that's a huge contribution. Then you have second behind that, but not a distant second, you still have Cornell faculty members doing research on critical issues, some in the biological sciences, a lot of it in the social sciences. And that, again, is a huge contribution. The world is always changing, so you need up-to-date research. You need to diagnose the problems as they are now. And the fact that Cornell has managed to maintain a distinguished record in international work means that it continues to make that that contribution. Now, I'm going to give you a little anecdote here. One of my most distinguished students was Tang Hui Li, who became president of Taiwan, and he's the person that brought democracy to Taiwan. He was the first native Taiwanese president. Before him, they'd all come from the mainland with Chiang Kai-shek and his son and so on. And when I went out, along with several colleagues from Cornell, to the inauguration of Tang Hui Li in a small meeting, I asked him, what was the most important thing you got from doing your PhD at Cornell? And I was all ready to fluff up my feathers and so on when he would say something about how much you learned from me and so on. And he said, John, the most important thing I learned was how democracy works. And of course, he didn't learn that from me. He didn't learn that in courses in the government department. He learned that by being there and seeing how a democracy really works. So this is a huge contribution of Cornell to things. Well, I have to end my anecdote. The follow-up question is, okay, what was the second most important thing? I learned how to play golf. Oh. He's a big golf fan. And we, as you know, we have a world-class golf course at Cornell. But just to summarize that, training these people in how to do research so that you formed agricultural universities like the College of Agriculture at Cornell, and then right into contemporary times, doing research. Those are huge contributions, and they're not to be underrated. And then as a side comment, keep in mind that those people who came from the Philippines and Taiwan and so on, they learned something about democracy. That's a significant contribution also. T.H. Lee wasn't the only one that learned something about democracy coming to Cornell.
As you look back on Cornell's history, certainly the Ford Foundation and USAID were instrumental in pushing along that development going into what, the 1980s. And since the 80s, that, as you've already suggested, has tapered off. What is the future for universities being involved in development activities?
Well, there are a lot of students from Asian and African countries that are in Latin America who are coming to Cornell, sometimes on their own money, sometimes their own governments are paying for it. So it hasn't disappeared. That's there. It's just criminal that the foreign aid program has largely gotten out of that kind of activity. There's a little bit of evidence of it coming back, but I it doesn't look all that strong to me. And the research support is very modest. I've done a lot of work in Afghanistan, and I used to push all the time. First thing you want to do is revive the institutions that were there in the 1970s. Those old guys are still around, and you can use them to develop this. And the aid people would say to me, no, no, but we need immediate results. And I would say to them, there's no more immediate result than reviving the agricultural research station in a province. And I remember when I talked to the director of agriculture in Paktika province in Afghanistan. I said, what would you think if USAID revived the ag experiment stations there? He, without a moment's hesitation, he said, he's a government employee, right? He is the government there. He said, it would immediately increase my reputation so much, which means that you get a quick response from higher education, from research station. You don't have to wait 10 years for the results. People see, oh, this is being revived. Our country's going to be going somewhere over the next decade. But I can never get the aid people to understand that's a very powerful impact. And I'm not very optimistic about aid coming back heavily into this area, and it's just criminal. Take an example. My son went to the hotel school at Cornell, and wherever he travels in the world, the people running the big hotels are Cornell graduates. There's an immediate interaction there. So we get that. When I travel and visit agricultural universities, they're always Cornell people there. But they're all dying off now. There are not so many coming along. So it's just horrible what's happened to the American Foreign Aid Program.
Let's go back for just a moment to
Am
some...
Am I allowed to say things like that?
Of course you are. You're allowed at your stage of life to say anything.
Yeah. I used to be the chief economist of aid in Washington, so I know the agency.
You know, yeah. Let's go back for just a moment to your earlier comments. The name Frosty Hill comes up frequently. What was his impact on you? He was your PhD advisor?
Yes. I think I came up with the idea of doing my dissertation on the southeastern United States, but it's quite possible that Frosty planted that idea with me. He was a great man and a very distinguished gentleman, and he encouraged me. I think he had it in mind when I was at the end of my undergraduate years and that I might come back on the faculty eventually at Cornell, but he wanted me to go somewhere else. So he helped me get a scholarship. I got a Fulbright scholarship to go to Oxford, and I worked with some distinguished agricultural economists at Oxford in those days, as well as a general economist. So Frosty led me into an interest in development. And then when I finished my PhD and went on the faculty, he encouraged me very much on the overseas development side, so that I think it probably is fair to say that I was influential, along with several other people, in what happened in development of international studies at Cornell in the modern era. And all of that's due to Frosty Hill. He's the one that led me in that. Art Mosier from the Agricultural Development Council somewhat, but Frosty Hill was a great man and very influential. By the way, he along with Bill Myers, who was the dean at that time, they were really the founders of the agricultural credit system in the United States, the Farm Credit Administration. So he brought, and I learned from him and from Sweet Hedlund, I learned how you develop an institution like that. We didn't have a credit system for agriculture before the 1920s, and so I got a connection all the way back. So he was a great teacher, and I owe so much to him.
Let's shift.
And that's Cornell.
Let's shift for a moment away from Cornell and over to John Mellor for a moment. You received a presidential award for your efforts to relieve hunger in the world. What is the relationship between relieving hunger and agricultural development? Is there a connection?
That's something that I drive at somewhat in my old book that you refer to, and have been driving at much more directly more recently. And I'm going to give a somewhat complicated answer to that question. Let me start with a simple part. You do any cross-section analysis across African, Asian, Latin American countries, and you find that when agriculture grows rapidly, poverty declines rapidly. If agriculture grows slowly, poverty doesn't decline. So there's a very clear statistical relationship there. And it follows from that that if the industrial sector grows rapidly and agriculture doesn't, you don't get much decline in poverty.
John Mellor concluded the interview with the following comment, and these are his words. You cannot understand Cornell's and the College of Agriculture's preeminence in working in developing countries without understanding the very long and distinguished history. Professor Love in China, Nanking University in the 1920s. In the 1930s, Cornell grad J. Losing Buck, husband of Pearl Buck, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist, on China. And his still relevant massive surveys of rural life in China, and his associates in China, Stan Warren and Glenn Hudden, from Cornell Agriculture Economics. And Mellor went on, in the post-war period, Richard Bradfield's close association with the Rockefeller Foundation and F.F. Hill's taking on the senior vice presidency of the Ford Foundation, both precursors of the Green Revolution. My work, said Mellor, in the late 1950s and 1960s, just grew naturally out of that and more distinguished history. And those were the words of John Mellor. John Mellor himself, a distinguished fixture in the Cornell International scenario.